Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, February 13th, 2014, and we're snowed in here in the East Coast. I don't think you're snowed in on the West Coast, Bill, but that's okay.
We're all in favor of Snowden in the East Coast.
Well, I thought Snowden was in Russia, but that's all right. So anyway, here are some of the headlines we're going to be looking at today. We'll talk about Snowden a little bit later on in the show. Plus, we're also going to talk about Rand Paul and what he has to say about Snowden's revelations and perhaps maybe even bring in a little wisdom from Ruth Buzzy. We're going to also, if we can get to it, talk a bit about what's going on with Obamacare. But we're starting off with what has really been our core topic for a long time, and it's about time we got back to it, and that's monetary policy. Because as it turns out, that's now starting to rear its ugly head in the news, especially now that Janet Yellen has taken over the Fed. And Bill, we're going to start off with what I thought was a rather cute headline on your part, debt ceiling broken till 2015. I didn't know you could break a debt ceiling. Is it like, you know, something you put together with glue or something?
Well, normally they raise the debt ceiling. You know, it goes up a little bit. But this time they didn't. They just broke the whole thing. They said, whatever you want to spend, go ahead and spend, borrow, big deal. Whatever you want until March 15th of 2015. Let's just get this thing past the election. We don't care how much debt there is. And
yeah, that's not so much breaking the ceiling. That's more like removing it.
Well, it's they broke it rather than raised it. It was the point of my little headline. But yeah, it was. I mean, Bonnier was saying, "Well, you know, this is going to be our best opportunity to get some concessions on spending from the administration." And yeah, they mulled over this, mulled over that, and they said, "Well, you know, the Senate isn't going to approve anything except a clean, you know, debt increase. So, you know, we don't want to argue about this. We'll argue about Obamacare for the next 6 months."
Okay, first of all, just a little housekeeping here. Yes. We've gone through a number of different pronunciations from you on the Speaker of the House. His name is Boehner, okay? John Boehner. We don't have to like him, but we'll at least try to pronounce his name right.
I've heard it two or three different ways. Yeah, Boehner, I think, is the correct pronunciation.
Yeah, let's go with Boehner.
Okay.
Then we can trash him.
I mean, you know, Boehner is kind of a bad term to be, you know, associating with a person. So.
Sorry. It's not important.
Boehner is the bane of the House.
Of course, all this now is being tied into the stock market because, of course, if you break the debt ceiling or remove it, as I prefer to describe it, you end up creating all that much more money that you can pour into the stock market. Now, here's a question for you. Does this break the stock market?
Well, it isn't the debt doesn't break the stock market because the debt actually helps. The more the government spends, the more that the big corporations get from the government, and you know they don't have to worry about their income. But what's kicking the stock market down, and it's been down like 24% since January 15th of 2014. What they're looking at is the charts that compare it to the 1929 stock crash, when a similar kind of, you know, buildup occurred over a decade or so, and then took a nosedive and then bumped up a little bit. And there's a lot of people that are a little spooked at looking at the comparative charts.
Well, they also have good reason to be spooked. I mean, we've talked about quite a bit how the whole stock market thing is a gigantic mirage created by the Fed.
We never called it a barrage. We called it
We could have said mirage. I mean, bubble. Basically the same thing. You know? The bubble is something that you build on that collapses while you're building on it. So
the market is basically still responding and will be for the next 6 months to the reduction in the quantitative easing.
Easing of the quantitative easing.
The easing of the quantitative easing, yes. No, it's called tapering. Tapering. Let's get our language straight here. Tapering of the QE.
Oh, that sounds more like candle making to me. I don't know. Maybe it's a term that's created by the people who are stock market investors, and they use technical analysis and they use candlesticks. Yeah, I know it's a stretch.
What?
Well, taper candles. I mean,
tapered candles. Oh, all right. Yeah, okay.
No, seriously.
Tapered pants or something. I don't know. Yeah, so anyway, that's...
I'm in a silly mood. What can I say?
You know, that's what the stock market is doing. I mean, the fact is that, and this is kind of a funny comment. I was watching Yellen at the congressman yesterday, who is the new replacement for Bernanke. And they asked her, well, you know, we're doing this sequester thing, and we're, you know, we're not spending as much money as we did you know, a few years ago, and the trend line isn't up, so you're kind of, you know, fighting against the tide here. And she said, yeah, we got to do this QE stuff, but we can't do it forever, so we got to taper off a little bit. And, of course, nobody made reference to the history of what's occurred over the past 2 years in terms of stimulus. One source, I think it was CNS News, made note of the fact that Bernanke had added $3.2 trillion during his term at the Federal Reserve to the total amount of currency in the United States. And that's what is supposed to stimulate, more fake money going into the coffers of the U.S. Treasury and Fannie and Freddie Mae and Mac and those guys, and eventually trickling up to the corporate headquarters that have made stock prices go up for the past year and a half.
And so I believe the $3.2 trillion figure comes from the fact that that's how much he actually added to the Fed's balance sheet, so that's how they're arriving at that one.
Yeah, well, in order to add it to the balance sheet, what does he do? He pushes a button on his computer and creates $2 million, or actually it was $85 million for a long time, with a push of a button.
Well, actually, he didn't push the button. He had a lackey who did that. But, yeah, your point is good.
Yeah, well, he had to write it down on paper or send somebody an email saying, you know, add another $85 billion to the monetary assets that we claim. And
which
so
like
they acquired, you know, they acquired this $4 trillion in assets, and it's on their books, and, you know, they've got... you know, treasury notes and all kinds of paper that says that they bought this stuff, but they bought it with fake money. They bought it with totally fabricated fiat currency.
But you have to understand what the mentality is of this person and the people who are backing him. I mean, basically, this is a George Jetson mentality, the one that complains about having to press 5 buttons in a single day. You know, that's why he has the lackeys who do it. And that's, you know, if you don't have the lackey doing it, then you can't continue to engage in the simplistic thinking required to believe that it actually is productive to create all this money out of thin air. There's a psychology to this, Bill. You got to really get with the program on this one.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, Yellen and Bernanke are heads of the Fed, so they never actually do any thinking. They just, you know, accumulate a consensus from the other Fed bank operators and let the peons scramble the numbers as much as they can, and then they come to a decision.
Now, we have found out what happens when a Fed chairman leaves the Fed.
Which is?
Well, he gets hired by the Brookings Institute.
I hadn't seen that, but it wouldn't surprise me. I kind of thought he'd go back to Goldman Sachs or something.
No, he got hired by the Brookings Institute as an economist. God knows why.
Did he have any credentials for being an economist?
I suggest you take that one up with the Brookings Institute, because they had their reasons for hiring him, I'm sure.
I can imagine they did. Fundraising.
Speaking of the Brookings Institute.
Yes.
There's a little article you dug up from Reason Magazine that references the Brookings Institute article. It has a rather interesting title. I think you may have rewritten it a little bit, but it doesn't matter. It pretty much captures the flavor of it. The poor are getting richer, too. And we've already kind of briefly touched base on the fact that we're probably going to disagree on this one, but why don't you educate our listeners as to what that article was all about?
Well, Reason Magazine was just basically doing a report on a Brookings Institute study or analysis of a CBO report, which was a study analysis of IRS data, and the topic was whether there was a difference in income inequality. And so they divide it up into quintiles, and I imagine most people understand quint is 5. So it's like five steps among the population, the lowest step being the poorest and the top step being the richest. And they looked at how well those different groups had improved their income over the past, 20, 30 years. And they basically came down to the proposition that the incomes of households in the lowest percentile was 37%, the next quintile was 36%, 45%, and then went up to the top 20% were, I don't find the number here, I think it was 64%. But that was all, you know, numbers out of the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. So the point was that it isn't just the rich that are getting richer, but that the poor are getting richer too.
Yeah, and there is a little bit of a problem with that. just a little tiny bit of a problem.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, first of all, the article wants us to believe that there is not an increasing gap between rich and poor.
No, that wasn't the point. There is
but they do want us to believe that. They do want us to believe that.
Well, they want us to believe that not just the rich, but the poor are getting better off, and there's not a whole lot of difference between the various groups.
Well, there's where you start to basically smear over the factual situation, because the fact is they do want us to believe, without actually seeing it, that there is not an increasing gap going on between rich and poor. Because if there is an increase going on in that gap, then it basically means that while there is perhaps, and we aren't even there yet, but there's perhaps some improvement that has been experienced by, shall we grossly call them, the poor, the fact of the matter is the gap does continue to grow, and it does continue to get bigger. And in fact, the reason article was the one that was trying to point heavily at that, and then they redirected around to this other thing. So, you know, that's one thing all by itself. It just kind of rubs me the wrong way. The reason the article itself is that the headline is "Why President Obama is Wrong on Inequality." Well, that's what inequality is about. Inequality is about the gap.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
that's misleading all by itself.
The common rhetoric is that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, or that the rich are getting richer at the expense of the poor.
And so
this was a contrary thing, saying, yes, the rich are getting richer faster, but the poor are also getting rich faster.
Here's another area where I have a problem with it.
Yeah.
None of the numbers are adjusted for inflation.
I think they are. According to CBO, it's real after-tax income.
Real tax income is not adjusted for inflation.
Well, if they call it real income, then that's considered inflation-adjusted, I think.
No, I don't believe so.
It's not, you know, literal or numeric after-tax income.
I'm pretty sure it doesn't.
I could go back and look. I didn't look for the inflation adjustment factor in the report. But, you know, I mean, your point is valid. If the lower quintile increased their income over, you know, 20, 30 years by 37%, and the top quintile increased by 58.3%, the separation between the two is getting larger. But the point was...
And not only that, if the bottom quintile increased by 37%, but the purchasing power over that same period declined by 62%, they didn't gain ground. They only gained ground nominally. They didn't gain ground actually. They lost ground.
Well, if these are not inflation-adjusted numbers, that might be true.
I'm pretty sure they're not.
We've already...
Let me give you one reason why I think they're not, okay?
Yeah.
It is a known fact that the purchasing power of the dollar since 1980, and this is fact-checkable, you can go almost anywhere on the net and prove it, the purchasing power of the dollar has declined by approximately 62%. Okay? It's also a known fact that the median income of Americans during that same time period increased by roughly 8 to 9%. So we know for a fact that Americans lost purchasing power. We know that absolutely for a fact before we even look at the IRS numbers.
Yeah.
So if the IRS has come up with numbers that said that even after inflation adjustment, they haven't in fact lost ground, I think we know that the IRS is lying somewhere. I think we know that for sure.
Well, I will look back at the CBO report and the Brookings report and see if we can't come up with some real definition of what they used in terms of inflation. But, yeah, I mean, your point is correct. whether or not the actual cost of living increment is real and is what people actually experience and as normal consumers is very debatable. I mean, you've indicated one number, but there are a lot of sources that have even higher numbers for the inflation effect over 20 or 30 years. And, of course, the whole purpose of the quantitative easing is to increase inflation.
Yeah, I mean, and the 62% is actually based on what the government's official numbers are. If you take what inflation probably really has been, it's actually a lot worse than that. But I'm doing it, conservatively, saying that the government is actually telling the truth in that case?
Government telling the truth?
Yeah, I know it's a bad assumption to make, but it's safer than, basically saying, well, we've lost 90% of our purchasing power.
However, there is another aspect of this, and that is that these quintiles, the one-fifth steps up the ladder, the mobility between one quintile and another changes every year.
Yeah.
So over the course of like 10 years, almost half of the people who were on the top rung of the ladder have fallen down. And half those who were on the bottom, rung of the ladder stepped up.
Yeah, there's some fluidity that goes on. Sure.
Yeah, and it's the fluidity has been pretty standard over the course of the past 40 years. It's something like 30% moved up or down two steps on the ladder, 20% moved up or down two steps on the ladder, and 10% took three steps on the ladder. In other words, rich
normal.
Don't stay rich.
That's normal for a free market because there are going to be people who make good decisions, there are going to be people who make bad decisions, and you're going to have consequences one way or the other depending on which way they went. Here's the thing, though. And this goes back to the core reason why we do the show focused around monetary policy. It's not a good thing. It's a really bad thing when all that is taking place in the context of and in the shadow of an overall system that constantly takes the value of money away by taking away the purchasing power. Because basically, at that point, the whole thing about whether some people are moving up and other people are moving down, that really is used to distract us away from the fact that we're all being robbed blind.
Yeah.
That bothers me a lot. That bothers me a whole lot. Now, there's one other thing here that I want to bring up that I think is probably the biggest flaw of this study that the Brookings Institute did. And by the way, I can cut you some slack because you didn't know that they hired Ben Bernanke. If you had known that they hired Bernanke, that should have been your first clue that there was something wrong.
I wouldn't even have brought it up. I wouldn't have been worthy of discussion.
But there's one gigantic flaw that we haven't even touched upon. When the Brookings Institute and when the CBO did their calculations, they did it based on what they called market income. And market income includes a number of things, most notably taxable income and capital gains. Now, here's the flaw in that. The flaw is there are huge amounts of income that fall into neither category. There are whole slews of income that end up being non-taxable income because of various tax shelters. And there are whole slews of unearned capital gains that never actually get earned, but nevertheless, they're still able to draw money on them. Again, taking advantage of the tax code, because there are thousands and thousands of loopholes in the tax code. So the numbers that the CBO is using completely understate the amount of resources, the amount of earnings, if you will, although you can't really call them earnings because earnings are specifically defined under the tax code, but if you take the more loose definition of earnings, there are huge amounts of earnings that aren't accounted for in this model. And you take those earnings into account. I'm not sure how you could even do it because most of those numbers aren't known to us. The most that we know is that the IMF tells us that there's something like $18 trillion hidden away in tax havens around the world.
The Tax Justice Network puts it at $21 trillion. It doesn't matter. It's a huge amount of wealth that's just secreted away and kept out of the tax picture entirely. But however you decide to calculate it, the bottom line is this. The numbers that the CBO put together are completely invalid because they can't count those missing dollars.
I don't know. I mean, for example, unrealized capital gains just means you bought stock and you haven't sold it yet.
Well,
and
it doesn't.
When you sell it, then it gets taxed.
It's fiscal level. But they actually have tax dodges, tax avoidance strategies that are legal. They're perfectly legal under the system that basically allow them to, in essence, trade those unearned capital gains for other assets that essentially allow them to keep that money as if it were income, but they don't treat it as income. And there, yeah. there are all these different these tax dodges that are engaged in by the wealthy because they can do it. They have the money to do it. They can hire the top accountants to help them do it. And in fact, there's a huge accounting industry that basically caters directly to the people who make $1 million a year or more in income or capital gains or some combination to help them accomplish this very goal. In fact, this is what Warren Buffett was complaining about a little while ago, where he complained that he's a billionaire who only gets taxed at 17%. I remember seeing an article that showed that when you have a millionaire may end up paying on average about 24%, depending on what kind of deductions they take.
Oh,
so you
yeah.
get 1.5%, 1.5 million, and now it starts getting down to around 21%. You get over $10 million in income, and now it gets down to around an average of 19%, and it starts to plateau off. Well, it's because of all these tax havens, these tax avoidance schemes that are perfectly legal under our crazy system.
Yeah, I have a sheep farm in Montana.
Better off.
And it's been losing money for 10 years now, and I just write it off my taxes. It's just an expense.
But the point is this. I mean, I don't even object to tax avoidance. I think that's a good thing. I do object to claiming that they have accounted for the universe of wealth earning in this country through their little structure they put together, and that structure can therefore be trusted to show us that there is not an increase going on in the spread between rich and poor, that there is in fact an improvement going on among the lower classes. It's the numbers themselves are not valid, and it's yet another example of how you just take whatever numbers you want to take, put them into whatever framework you want to, and say, oh, geez, well, I've proven that such and such is true. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other point that relates to that is the simple fact that the tax code is however many thousands of pages, who knows how many IRS regulations, 50, 80, 150,000 different regulations. The average person has no means or capability, much less the extraneous resources, to be able to hire somebody to figure out how they can take advantage of all those things. Whereas large corporations and rich people hire somebody and they, you know, they get a CPA or they get a law degreed person to go through all this IRS tax code and say, hey, where can I take advantage of this? And that was basically what happened in the housing crisis. They went through the tax code and they said, hey, you know, we'll throw our money at this thing and we won't have to pay taxes on it.
I saw an article at accountingdegree.org that itemize the top 10 ways that the uber wealthy avoid paying taxes.
Yeah.
Number 10 was tax havens. Number 9 was shell companies.
That's my sheep farm in Montana. There's no sheep there, so it loses money every year.
No. Number 8 was equity swaps. That ties in with what we were talking about unrealized capital gains. And number 7 is a variation on it also, avoiding capital gains tax. Number 6 was evading the estate tax. Number 5 was shell trust funds. Number 4, incorporating and taking advantage of incorporation rules. Number 3, payments in kind, like using gold and silver instead of dollars to make your payments for whatever it is you're doing. Number 2, borrowing against life insurance. Amazing the different things you can do when you borrow against a life insurance policy. The little games you can play to avoid paying income. Just incredible. And number one on the list, real estate borrowing.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's one that everybody gets a shot at. You know, I mean, at least everybody that owns a home or quote-unquote owns a home. They're paying interest to a bank or somebody. But, for decades, I took the home mortgage deduction, and it cut my taxes way down. So that's probably the most popular deduction of anything.
I'm willing to bet, though, you didn't have a $2 million property that you were able to take a 75% loan on equity, giving you $1.5 million of tax-free borrowing, then go bankrupt, declare bankruptcy, wipe away all your debts, and start all over again, taking advantage of the fact that you had that $1.5 million tucked away at the Cayman Islands.
Yeah, that's been going on since I was a teenager, because I remember my mom talking about a friend of hers who did exactly that. They put $1 million into one thing or another for a tax dodge and collected the money and then put that into an offshore account or whatever it was and declared bankruptcy. And they declared bankruptcy every 3 years. And that was how they got as rich as they were. That's why they had this huge mansion up on the hill. And I recall that from way back when. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the tax code itself is a... From my perspective, if you put it in legal terms or the constitutional terms, it's a gross violation of the 14th Amendment. There is not equal protection under the law. And there are people that take advantage of the system, get regulations and laws and rules and subsidies and all kinds of things that the average Joe Blow can't even touch.
And that's the thing. I don't mind that they take advantage of it, but everybody should be able to take advantage of it. Everybody should be able to get rid of the burden. And that's my problem with it. I don't like the fact that the masses are basically stuck with the tax bill because of the way the tax...
They can buy into my sheep farm in Montana.
I don't really like sheep very much. Well,
for a small fee, I will give them 50% interest in my sheep farm in Montana.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a break. During the break, you can try to sell me a share in your sheep farm. And then after the break, we're going to pick up on NSA spying. And if we can get to it, we'll get to Obamacare. That sounds fair to you?
Go for you.
All right. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. And we will be right back. On the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walton Bill on this Thursday evening. And Bill, before the break, we were talking about, among other things, people who find ways to reduce their tax bill. I don't know if you heard about this one. This is a few months back. But IMF Chief Christine Lagarde, you may remember she mm-hmm. was very famous for blaming the Greeks for causing their financial peril by dodging their own tax bills. Mm-hmm. Did you know that she paid no income taxes? I'm serious.
Wouldn't surprise me. Wouldn't surprise me. No, I mean, your point about real income taxes is a valid one. I know Mitt Romney got into all kinds of trouble with that issue. Yeah, I think he ended up with paying like an actual tax percentage of 18% or something like that, 19%. That's pretty common for almost every politician. They never get above the 18 or 19% because they know the tax code, or they have somebody who knows the tax code inside and out. But yeah, there's lots of people that I wouldn't. You know, I love Bill Gates because I'm really impressed with everything he's done.
Haven't used Microsoft software very much, but no, go ahead.
We won't talk about that. Bill Gates seems like a nice guy, but he's given like $3 billion or whatever it is to African health clinics or whatever. I just wonder whether that $3 billion, which is of course tax deductible, mm-hmm. isn't getting him off like $2 or $3 billion in taxes every year.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Profits from Microsoft.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Sure.
I mean, that's aside from home equity, the charitable contribution thing is probably number one or number two or somewhere on your list for evading taxes. I mean, you create your own charitable organization, you donate all your money to it, and you don't have any income, and it's a tax tax relief, you know, non-taxable tax refund charity.
That's right.
So you get to direct where all the money goes and what it's used for, but you don't pay any taxes on it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Ain't it a wonderful thing?
Wonderful world.
Speaking of wonderful things, yeah. This is more along the line of quixotic. Quixotic? Wonderful things.
Quixotic.
But Senator Rand Paul filed a lawsuit against President Obama. Now, it's not one that's likely to go anywhere, but hey, it's interesting. He did, though. And he got 350,000 people to do it with him.
It's obviously a political move because he wants to corner that particular issue, which has wide public popularity. But there are a dozen other lawsuits that are already in the grinder. I did read through this one, and the only unique thing about it was that they are trying to file it as a class action suit.
Mm.
In other words, everybody who uses phone should get $5.28 from the NSA for having violated their Fourth Amendment rights. So that's a novel thing. But the lawsuit that Paul is doing, he's kind of lending his name to FreedomWorks, which wants to get in on the NSA issue. And they picked up an attorney, Kim Cuccinelli, who lost the gubernatorial campaign in Pennsylvania or somewhere.
Virginia.
And so, it's as credible as any other lawsuit. Whether it's going to be the decisive thing, more likely than not, all these are going to be batched together for the Supreme Court to look at. It'll be interesting.
They have a really difficult problem, though. And I, unless you know something from the lawsuits that I don't know about, I would say it's an insurmountable problem. And that is, in order for a class action lawsuit to go forward, all of the members of the class have to be able to show damage. It has to be damage that you can somehow enumerate.
Right. Yeah.
I don't see how they're going to do that.
Well, their proposition in the text is that everyone has been injured when their Fourth Amendment rights are violated, and that they deserve to be compensated for violation of their privacy. And that's not an uncommon kind of argument as far as federal court cases are concerned.
Well, it is uncommon in terms of federal court cases that actually win.
Right.
Lots of cases are filed that don't have a prayer that are filed by that kind of idea. Well, it violates my Constitution. My constitutional rights are being violated.
Yeah,
but unless it actually shows that there was an actual tangible damage, then it starts to become really difficult to win that case.
Yes, I agree.
It's
obviously a political document, and obviously they wanted to say, we're arguing on behalf of the 300 million people who use telephones. And
now, I have to admit, I did have a fantasy where this was concerned. The fantasy was that Rand Paul's attorneys are smart enough to get it to the point where the court says, well, what are the damages? Where is the actual damage going on? And the lawyers say, well, as with everything else with this whole thing, the whole thing is under wraps, so we have been denied access to the data that we need to find out where the damage was actually done. So we want to basically interview all NSA employees.
Well, that's one of the side benefits of any of these lawsuits is that they get to demand documentation from the defendant. And of course, the defendant, being the NSA or the administration or whatever, just says, hey, it's a national secret. You can't look at that. But nevertheless, there have been a number of disclosures that confirm a lot of the Snowden documents and confirm a lot of the things that the NSA is alleged to have been doing. We now know they were doing, and there's probably more to come in that vein. Like I say, the Rand Paul suit is basically a political document, not a legal document, and it's rather sloppily written. I think it's more likely that the other dozen or so NSA cases are the ones that are going to end up at the Supreme Court, arguing that the NSA is violating court precedent, including the case that they constantly cite, which is Smith, which supposedly made it legal for the government to take business records and telephone records and the internet records and anything else whenever they wanted to for any reason they wanted to.
because we don't have a right to privacy.
Right. Well, and you know, the point that the NSA advocates constantly say, well, it's legal. You know, it's under this provision of the law. We're complying with this provision of the law. Of course, the law itself is a violation of the Fourth Amendment because it sets up other criteria than probable cause for, you know, violating the individual's, every individual's right to be secure in their persons, property, papers, and effects.
I mean, truly, every unconstitutional law ever passed was the law.
That's true. That's true. And then on the issue of oversight, there was a debate, and people, if they're interested in some of these issues, there's an organization called IQ2 that sponsored a debate on whether or not Snowden's revelations were justified. So if you just Google Snowden IQ2, you can watch that debate. But one of the other arguments, they say, well, there's all kinds of oversight. You know, there's oversight from Congress. Well, all the heads of the Intelligence Committee said, we had no idea that this was going on when the Snowden documents first came out. They say 53 different federal judges have, or no, it wasn't 53. It was something like 15 federal judges have said this is perfectly legal, not mentioning that 11 of those judges are members of the FISA court, which meets in secret and whose documents were never revealed until Snowden said, distributed them. So, you know, it's an amusing argument. Another amusing thing is that apparently, according to some leaker in the NSA who's probably going to be put in jail and fried, the NSA can't keep up with cell phones. So they aren't, in fact, collecting every cell phone conversation. They're barely getting 30% of your phone IMs and your pictures and your messages and so on. They just can't keep up, which is why they happen to be building a new data center right next to my sheep farm up in Montana because they just don't have enough storage space in Virginia or wherever their center is. So they're collecting less than 30% of the call records in the U.S.
I'm curious, how much data can you store in a single pound of sheep wool?
Well, how many tetrabytes can you fit into 3,427 Microsoft Windows systems?
Yeah.
Because they don't use supercomputers anymore. All they do is they string together a bunch of microcomputers. They get a bunch of Macs, and they pull out the board, and they put it in this big rack, and they have some Unix software running all, you know, 3,000 different processors at the same time. But they literally have collected tetrabytes of information. That's a lot more than the megabyte or gigabyte that you have on your computer.
I'm trying to imagine how this whole thing got started. I'm wondering if the government took its cue from Google, because Google was really the first one to string together all the microcomputers, I think. I can't think of anybody else who did it before them. So I wonder if they were the model.
Unix is pretty much open source, and I think there were a lot of entrepreneurs, and there were a few companies like Fujitsu and maybe even IBM that got into this.
Yeah, but none of them had actually put together the kind of array that Google had put together.
Google's massive.
Yeah,
you know, almost.
And theoretical, you know.
Yeah, but there was actually an article I read indicating that Facebook had surpassed Google in terms of user data.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Both in terms of quantity and content.
Yeah.
I was
pointing out that Google was the first big one, that's all.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I figured they might be the model, you know, but, well.
Yeah, could be.
By the way, did you hear that Snowden was supposedly, according to the NSA claims that Snowden got into a number of the systems by stealing his colleagues' passwords, and Snowden vehemently denied that. That was kind of an interesting little side show,
yeah.
I thought.
Yeah, I mean, the NSA just makes up stories about, you know,
well, that's the job.
It is. I mean, their job is to deceive the world.
Unless they're beat to it by a politician like Representative Mike Rogers, who said, yes, I'm absolutely certain that Snowden sold all these documents to the Soviet Union.
I mean,
not realizing the Soviet Union didn't exist anymore.
Their task in life is to basically steal everyone else's secrets and make sure that none of what they actually do out there, so they lie about everything so that they can protect American business. I mean, we already know that. We talked about that. So, of course, they're lying.
Well, in this debate that I watched almost all of, there was an allegation from the NSA that Snowden had pilfered 1.7 million documents. And the NSA guys who were defending the program said, well, this is what Snowden said. And I said, no. This is a total fabrication created by NSA. And all they did was they looked at his access codes, and they determined which computers he had access to, and they just assumed they took everything on all of those computers.
And you have to give the NSA credit, though, because they invent a fact, and then they claim knowledge of the fact based on what Snowden did. I love that. I mean, that's great. You got to admit, that's great deception. That's really top-grade deception going on there.
Yeah. No, it's I don't know. I listen to these NSA and CIA people when they testify to Congress. And they're better than a lot of politicians at using mealy-mouth words to either affirm or deny something that they don't want to talk about.
It's funny, too, because the old joke about politicians when they're this movie, you know they're lying.
Yeah.
It actually is true of NSA representatives. But politicians sometimes tell the truth.
Yeah.
But if you can see somebody from the NSA talking, you know for a fact that they're lying. It's nice to have that level of consistency, don't you think?
Well, it started off square one a couple decades ago that NSA stood for no such agency. They wouldn't even admit
right.
They existed. They were in the black budget of the CIA. Nobody knew that they were. There was even such a.
Yeah, you couldn't even
department.
Acknowledge their existence if you had any dealings with them. You had to pretend they weren't there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true. And, they talk about congressional oversight. Anything that might have been accessible by somebody in Congress, very, very few people, they could not talk about. I mean,
and I don't think that was an oversight either.
No. I mean, the two senators, Wyden and Sensenbrenner, who have been pissed off about this for a long time, did know what was going on, and they couldn't say anything.
Mm.
They could not tell their constituents, nor the press, nor anybody else, what they had read the day before. So that's what oversight consists of. I mean, we're overlooking everything.
It's reassuring to know that the people who are providing the oversight can't actually provide the oversight, because to do so would be to violate national security.
Right. Exactly. I mean, this point didn't come up in the debate, but all of this information belongs to the people of the United States. It doesn't belong to James Clapper or some NSA department. It belongs to the people. And if the people can't discuss it and their representatives can't debate it because nobody is allowed to talk about it, then how can you have anything that's considered oversight? It's a violation of the ownership of the American people of the product of their government.
Well, at the very least, we won't even mention how it's a violation of their privacy, of their right to basically freely associate, of their right to free speech, of their right to assembly. I mean, it basically violates all the rights. But if you want to take that one out, sure, that's okay.
Yeah, no, it's... There have been two changes. You'd be happy to know, aside from the fact that the NSA can't collect all of the cell phone data.
But not because they haven't tried.
They did try, and they gave up.
This is the same NSA that we know they lie every time, so it probably means they've already figured out how to start collecting it. Now they're collecting all of it.
Right. But the latest changes, of course, Obama had a speech saying, well, we're going to rein in the NSA. And so they released a document from the FISA court, and FISA is just Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Authority. So this court, which is actually just one person sitting in a room in the Pentagon, put out a statement that they were implementing two of Obama's suggestions. One was that rather than using their three hops to connect one, you know, supposed terrorist with other people who are associated with him, they were going to do only two hops.
Explain what a hop is, because that's going to lose some people.
So Mohammed calls Joe's Pizza, and he orders a pizza. And the next minute, you call Joe's Pizza and order a pizza. When the NSA gets those two phone calls, they consider the terrorist, Mohammed, to have been one hop away from the pizza shop and two hops away from you. So you are now associated with a terrorist on the basis of the NSA doing two hops. Now, if they do three hops and you call your mother-in-law, now your mother-in-law is a terrorist. So rather than doing the three hops, they're now going to do two hops.
What if you do an IHOP? No, sorry. I couldn't resist.
The other thing they're going to do is that they have decided that and this is something that's a little bit technical. When the NSA collects all this information, they don't look at it. When they look at it, it's called targeting. And the targeting is done either by an analyst typing in a phone number, and it searches the whole database for that phone number, or they take a list of phone numbers of supposed terrorists, and they just run the entire list against recent phone calls to find out who these phone numbers talk to. Well, in the past, the court oversight consisted of them reviewing the procedures. And if the procedure said that the NSA had to have articulable, I could never say that word, articulable suspicion for a particular phone number to be targeted. So now the FISA court is going to look at each one of those targets and determine whether or not there is articulable suspicion. Articulable means you can say what you suspect.
Unfortunately, you're having trouble doing.
Yes, if you can get your tongue untwisted after saying articulable. So if you can articulate, that's an easier word. If you can articulate what your suspicion is in front of the FISA court, then everything is keen and dandy, and they're going to check it off, and that's going
to
be okay. So
it's
in the past, they weren't
addiction.
In the past, this FISA court, it's a secret court that nobody knows anything about unless they choose to reveal it, is going to take the NSA's testimony saying, we suspect this guy, and therefore we're going to target him, and we're going to do a search on the database for any contacts that he made with anybody in the United States or foreign countries. And now, instead of just having a program approved by the court is actually going to have to look at each number and decide whether, not probable cause, just that they can articulate some suspicion about the people whose phone numbers are being searched. Mm-hmm. So if they can say, we think Walt Thiessen is on our ass, and that probably means he's a terrorist. And so we suspect that he's, you know, affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Then they can use a number. They don't have to prove anything. They don't have to provide any evidence.
I would say that qualifies as reined in, particularly if you misspell reined as R-A-I-N-E-D. And what you really mean is that you create a little artificial cloud inside the NSA building and a reined. That would be reined in, wouldn't it? That's pretty much what we have in this case. So, yeah, I feel much safer. I mean, my privacy is now protected, as you very eloquently described.
There you go. You now have an umbrella over your head that's safeguarding you against...
I need it with all this rain.
All that rain, yeah.
Hey, you dug up a really good Ruth Buzzi quote from number. I don't know. I'm not sure how old the quote is, but Ruth Buzzi, for those who don't know her, she's from back of the days of Rowan and Martin laughing in the 1970s. She was a great comedian, and she has a particularly poignant quote to share with us about the nature of government and, I guess, of the NSA.
But this was a tweet, and it was a recent one.
Oh, so it is recent. It was a tweet.
Eh? This is what she tweeted.
Okay.
Maybe we should email one another the Constitution, so the government would read it.
Yeah, there's a flaw in that, though. It's a cute tweet. I love it. Yeah. But it also implies, well, first of all, not just the government would read it, but that the NSA would read it. And secondly, it also implies that they would understand it.
Well,
I mean, you have to admit, that's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
Because most of these people, and it's not just the NSA, I mean, many conservatives, many liberals, many moderates, their understanding of the Constitution is so weak that they use words like liberty and freedom, and they mean absolutely nothing close to what you and I mean, to what the average person means by those words.
Yeah.
Their idea of what liberty and freedom are among many.
Yeah. No, I mean,
entirely different from what we have in mind.
Yeah, I read a lot of legal blogs, and there's all kinds of attorneys out there who make money off the surveillance state because they're giving legal advice to all sorts
mm-hmm.
of corporations and so on.
Yeah.
And something simple. I mean, this is one sentence in the Constitution. It's a Fourth Amendment. And if you read it, it's very straightforward. It says exactly what it says, which is that every person shall be secure in the person, property, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches. And there they put a period. They consistently do this where there is no period. It goes on and says what reasonable is. And the only reasonable violation of those rights, those privacy rights, is when there is sufficient warrant, literally a warrant against a person showing specific evidence that they have probably been engaged in some criminal activity. There is a probable cause to believe that that specific individual is engaged in something criminal. And that's the only reasonable exception to the rights that are specified in the Fourth Amendment. So,
well, it's a good thing then that they finally found a way to basically throw all that aside so that you can have the NSA, because, man, that would be a real stumbling block if we had that in the way, I tell you.
Oh, if the NSA went away, what would we do? All those terrorists would come running to our borders and blowing up things.
Well, Bill, we've come to the end of another wonderful hour, but it's been a pleasure as usual.
Yes.
And we will see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. Run.